government is policy connected as a society need to respond to these things. So that's why we chose this as a global change for climate. And many countries in the world are talking about climate change more and more as opposed to climate change from a scientific perspective. The political agenda is driven by climate change because it's about emission reduction. And then we talk about the economy and the issue. There's one other reason why global change is important, and that is when we look at us responding to these changes, and we talk about the low carbon economy, some people are saying we should not necessarily be talking about the low carbon economy. We thought that we should be talking about the low resource utilization economy, because it's more than carbon that we have to be worried about. It's about how much steel we put into the how much waste we can invest, and it's not all about carbon. So in some way, Sarajevo is ahead of the curve on a scientific level in terms of adopting this as a global change grand challenge and not climate change grand challenge. And I think when I talk through the kind of research that we've been focused on, what I want to just leave people with in terms of this slide, and I'll go into the details, is that the science plan has been, these issues link up with each other. But there's four major areas of focus. And they deal in some way with the multiple mandates that the DSP has. We have a mandate to encourage good science. We have a mandate to make sure that South Africa is a science destination. But we also have a mandate to make sure that our research contributes to policy, to decision making. So if you look at this, you can see that we have a place for everything. We have a place for basic curiosity every time. This may not have a direct, but it's very important to apply science with big kind of challenges. But as we move from the green to the green, bring that in, it becomes a lot more relevant and a lot more interesting for policymakers. So we've organized the research plan in terms of four key knowledge challenges. The first is understanding the changing trends. The second is reducing the human footprint. The third is adapting the way we live. And then our mandate is to look at innovation. And we say what we need to do is to increasingly look at innovation. What I'm going to do is talk through each of those areas a bit more. The slides I sent to previously had a lot more detail about what are the kind of topics we're going to cover in these areas. But if people are interested in the more detailed research plan, depends when you read it, you may be getting the final set of comments on your research plan and then moving towards the final version of the launch. So pretty much the end of the plan. One point is that when you look at the first theme, understanding the changing climate, that has a greater role to play in terms of our enhancing our fundamental understanding, not only from a scientific perspective, from a global perspective, around the change in climate. We're saying that that theme is not related only to climate, but we are endowed with the southern oceans and the southern tip of Africa. We have very unique geographical characteristics. And those patterns, what is happening in our southern oceans, affects weather patterns in Japan. We sit and look in Japan, where they're interested in some phenomena here which have impacts in their own weather, but also in the north. So that is a very much a globally focused area of interest. That's where we would get the articles and theories in China. And that's where we will spend time building up South Africa as a science-based destination around the southern oceans, not only our southern coast. So the remaining have a much more national focus, and it's the kind of area that will inform the future of these sites. So if you look at the first theme, there are five very specific areas of focus. One is observation, monitoring, and adaptive management. And part of what we're trying to do here is as part of our requirements around Earth observation, and people are aware, we have a space venture as well, we have developing Earth observation projects. Unfortunately, we couldn't launch the satellite yesterday because of Chinese in Russia. But this is part of that effort to say, as part of our requirement to get space-based data, we need to understand things like that. We need to look at observational factors. We need to look at more weather buoys, more hydrological stations. We understand what is happening in our areas. So this knowledge is traced in the form of the being around the body. The second area is equally important, and it is built on very, very strong research data that we have over the last 30 topics. We have important work that we do on the current emotions, understanding the Mandela current, other Antarctica program, etc. This is trying to build on that area focus. It was written very specifically to be able to attract researchers from other parts of the world who want to come and spend time in the country. And there's a lot of interest in the current emotions and in trying to stay in the institutional platform to attract us. In that way, it will help us with our own knowledge base. The third is an area that we are also very uniquely positioned. It's not something that is well known as our astronomy work or our southern oceans work, but there are some very interesting work happening in the institutes, in the Council for Geoscience, the Hermetic, Magnetic Observatory, around deep earth and what is happening in deep earth around the movement of the tectonic plates and our own unique geological record. Again, we have some features in Mpumalanga, etc., that are unique in the world. There's no other site to keep that kind of historical record. And this research area tries to find this. The fourth area is linking the land, the air, and the sea. And this is, in fact, the big area for new science. We have people who think of the atmosphere, we have people who are oceanographers, we have people who are land-based movements. But these things are complex systems. They interact with each other. People have found, for example, the El Nino, which is a sea-based phenomenon, with impact on the weather patterns 1 year later in Central Asia. So if you understand what is happening in the ocean, you're able to predict a lot more clearly what is likely to happen with climate, with weather, etc., which is the first one, is improving water conditions. So this is a very fundamental science research. This is the one that gets the scientists excited. This is the one that gets me most excited, because I think it's kind of what we do, and that it's more of a policy. So there's a bit of everything in the science. The second area, which I think is increasingly becoming important, and it's going to be an area that will generate and needs to generate a lot more informed research in the next 3 years. The first is reducing the human system. As I indicated earlier, it's not only about carbon, it's about our gender, consumerist society that we live in. All indications are that, you know, established patterns of production and consumption are going to reach a tipping point. The problems of peak oil, natural resource base is increasingly unexplained, water is a scarce resource, etc. There's a whole range of perspectives. There's work that is happening under the UN now, which are going to be equally important, with the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which looks at resource management and what is going into the system, and how do we reduce the overall amount of per capita resource used in the US. As South Africa, these issues have a very unique perspective though. We are a developing country, and it's something that I will touch on when we talk about the climate change negotiations. We cannot afford to put our own development objectives at risk. We can't compromise poverty in education or improving the quality of life because we now have the resources. So there has to be unequal burden sharing in some. The developed world has to take on a greater role. We can't stop us from developing. And that's a key sticking point, because we've been forced to say, yes, the climate is in crisis, the earth is in crisis, and China and India and South Africa and other countries must now do more than the station. So what we need to be doing is also looking at this in a global context. What are issues of justice and fairness in some, and it's not part of this community. But whatever happens at the international level, whatever the debates are around the just path for global development, inside Africa, we need to start moving towards, for example, waste elimination, some very basic. But, you know, since 1970, our minister commented when we presented this, we've been talking about this. But the notoriously dead, we still don't have the systems in place for separating waste, or even reducing waste such as this cost. The very interesting development, technology can help, the policy measures can help themselves. We're not just saying what happens in the international space, it's in our interest to look at these. These are also sectors that have potential to create new jobs, when we talk about new industries and new jobs. So this theme is going to be enhancing our knowledge. What behavior changes are required in our system? What kind of incentives? What kind of regulation? What kind of punishment do we need for business, for society to ensure that we are conscious of those issues in the system? Our colleagues in the environment today will tell you that they are very good at effective communication. And what we need to do is come in with research that supports us in dealing with it, but also in terms of technology. Preserving biodiversity and ecosystem services is an equally important area of work. We've had a number of important issues in our system department, the Department of Environment and Ecology previously, which shows across our land-based ecosystems, ocean-based ecosystems, that they are mixed up. And the significant stress is issues of our fish stocks, the issues of our river systems, people are aware of things like mine drainage, etc. This challenge tries to enhance our understanding of this so that we can take the committee is also aware that there's discussions now in this document about the public comments around the National Planning Commission. Long term planning is going to require us to look at these issues from a long term perspective. A long term perspective requires this time. Good knowledge, because that's when we can break away from the short-term political constraints. So part of this is what do we envision will happen to our ecosystem 2 to 25 years' time, and what do we need to do differently? Importantly is that this is not only about hard technology, it's about institutional arrangements. We share water bodies with our neighboring countries. There's water management issues that are important. There are other resource management issues. We need to research that looks at the global situation, what other people are doing, and how to manage that to avoid it. This kind of research will also inform policy at levels like this, with new legislation. How do you execute these? So that theme is geared towards both hardcore technology development, soft core policy measures, incentive arrangements, economic issues that allow us to do this. The third theme is adapting the way that we work. And there's a couple of things that we need to do here. The first, which is very strongly linked to disaster management, is prepare for rapid change and extreme events. We need research and technology tools and other tools that allow communities to better respond if they need, for example, to start having a risk of stuff. But how do we also build resiliency? Very importantly, there's a global trend. We do have a Ministry for Rural Development, but the trend is that cities are much more important, they're concentrated, they have a big impact in terms of resource utilization, whether it's water or energy or carbon, etc. And cities are a big focus internationally around how do you design it to be necessary. Data around DRTs, walkways, etc., around sustainable urban development. This way you will see significant possibilities for reducing overall waste. So we have a very specific theme to say how do we plan for sustainable urban development, but taking into account the South African context. We're not Europe, where we are smaller, we have a large country, a single state, there is the cases, how do we say corridors, how do we break about the spatial pattern so that the deep contribution to our carbon emissions and you know, so forth, if we can travel 2 hours sitting a bus or a train, then we should be looking at new settlement systems and people like every other city where we live. How do we break it? How do we plan in the long term around new sustainable urban development and new sites that come up? We have good models, you know, past year we have good challenges, but we have experiences that we can draw on, and we can draw on experiences from others. In 3 and 4, I would fear that our key challenges come out of technology. And this is the place where we are looking at providing the focus. If you look at our main challenges, we do have something around water, for example. We have energy resistance. The energy resistance is a very important focus. However, people are saying that water is equal important. And we are already facing major limitations. Water security becomes a key problem. The more recent projections show that we are going to become drier. Even if all of humanity, all of the globe, suddenly has zero emissions, which is not possible. Even if we cut our emissions down to zero, we're going to be facing this problem from 100 years back. And we are going to become tired. So we need to look at this and how we manage water security and water. We are the projections. Where do we enhance our knowledge around where we're going to have water security problems? So if we don't build urban settlements, the settlements there, only to find that 2 years down the line, we're going to have water. Food and fiber security is equally important. It has links to water, but it's around how do we use our environment to be more arable, to use different kinds of crops that we use to focus upon. Do we start doing research now on drought-resistant crops, as an example? We're doing this already, say, with wine industry. They have an extent of what is going to happen in this part of the world. They need to start projecting the future, finding out new seeds that will be able to withstand higher rainfall patterns or earlier seasons coming into the future. So there's a whole challenge around this.
Why
don't
you want to do it?
Not me personally, that's, I don't do that and I don't encourage that, but it's an industry, so I'm talking with them. It is an industry. So we have some of the problems around wheat, as an example. Toilets, for example, all of our wheat is collected from one cheese crop. Suddenly we have a dry condition, we can wipe out our wheat in some way. So we need to project, and this is probably knowledge in some way. But these are 20-30-year issues. So there is very important work happening under the ARC where we're taking, for example, old genes, traditional genes for animals and looking at how we plan for different climatic conditions in the future. This is a 10-year plan, and what I need to indicate, though, is that clearly a lot of these challenges are not 10 years, they're 15 years, and you will see that a big area of focus over the next 10 years is not only the research, but the research. If we leave at the end of this 10 years with a view that we can increase our global change pool of people, 5 or 6, then it would be as important an outcome as having successful research. Finally, the area of innovation for sustainability, which is part of the mandate of this year, is to push the boundaries on innovation and to look at that. For example, we have resilience and capability, we have issues around options for greening the development of things. And the DSC is ideally positioned because it's not constrained by the current challenges that our Department of Mineral Resources or Energy or they have to face the current in the now in terms of being able to deliver that. To be able to think of it more broader and introduce new ideas into that. And part of this is trying to say, what is those innovation areas that we need to spend more funding on? We need to be planning now, we need to be building the human capital base now, is it the renewable energy sector? We need 10 times more people in those areas to be able to do this. If we're talking about generally reducing our resource consumption? How do we work with the mining industry or with other industries to do this? This requires our long-term planning. Hopefully the research and knowledge base that our interests, I mean, we have a very, very solid core science and globally as well, and how do we use that coming from our field? So that's the fourth thing. In the previous slide, I tried to capture in bullet points very specific research questions that give you a sense of what to do, but I hope I've been able to give you a flavor of what to do. To end off, we are doing work in most of these areas, but what the research field has allowed us to do is to say these are the 15 knowledge fields that we need to really focus on. We need to encourage our young to look at this in the area. We need to create the instruments to be able to do this, and this is what I want to talk about now. What are we now trying to do to allow us to achieve that? So key performance indicators for the Grand Challenge are the following. At the top of our list is human capital development and transformation. We have an impressive core of scientists, and the fundamental scientists, we do have people, but it's a fragile. Few people, the demographics are not right, we need to change. So a key feature of this is to build more master PhD students, but also to change the race, gender, and other compositions of our scientific force, that we have sustainable generation of our scientific capacity. We need to develop our knowledge base and assets. For example, if we want to do more detailed studies on water stress, we need a bigger network of hydrological stations. So this is what we need to be testing and measuring, etc. And we are doing this. We need to, the satellite is one example, we need to enhance of Earth observation, but you want to track and measure this. Very importantly is making an impact on the economy and society. So this Grand Challenge findings must find its way into the portfolio committee, the cabinet, and we have some very specific ideas on how we want to do this and assess the building of change. And then finally, we need to enhance our education and climate destination. And I can say with no reservation that we're doing this quite effectively. Every week we are engaging with different partners, Germany, Norway, Spain, etc. One, two, three, four, even our expert colleagues want to work with us. At the same time, as our institutions of learning, some of our institutions, to be part of a very interesting time, which is not theoretical for today, but it's globally relevant. This is a model that we developed to give a sense of the institutional platforms that we're planning to create over the next 10 years. Some exist, but this has allowed us to bring the number of players together by the festival, and I think everything is close to this. This group of people were working quite remotely over the last 2 years with the Global Chief of Land Challenge. People have come together and have created very interesting new areas of focus. People are talking in interdisciplinary ways. For scientists and science policymakers like ourselves, they're very interesting. When you go to other countries, say India, how are you able to get your oceanographers to talk to your human social and social scientists in the same room? And your science then is just basic science and fundamental science and applied science. How do you get a group of people to work together? So we're quite beneficial in this because they cost learning is a very interesting possibility. I'm going to talk through some of this. The one thing I realized in my slides that I do talk about is the knowledge brokering portion that we want to use. Knowledge brokering is a very specific session expertise, and I must compliment the parliamentary research officers for doing this. But what we want to do is, if the research comes up, from the 10-year research that we want to issue 1 to 2 page research, so that they don't stay in the scientific. But we learned, so we had a workshop on evidence-based policy making about a year ago. You don't do a summary of the research. You actually have to rewrite it for the policy making. You need to make explicit why are you saying this is a problem that me as a parliamentary officer, as an example, or a member of parliament, field. And the scientists have acknowledged that they're not the best people. And if someone who has a policy knowledge that you understand the science, and you want to support that explicitly, you want to create a generation of people who are able to do that. There's small units of the community are if you want to build it for that. Some of the very specific beyond the rush to the negotiations now, some of the important areas in soliciting that additional information is setting up something called ESSES, which now is called Applied Scientific Climate and Earth System Studies. It's a very important, it's been positioned as a global center of excellence. Just to summarize, that the work is very exciting, they're taking an interdisciplinary and have brought in the ocean scientists, the land scientists, air scientists, the human scientists, and the international. You'll hear more about this. The excess has its hub at the CSIR, but most of the work is concentrated in Cape Town. I think when possibilities to site things, this is one of the ones you mentioned. You can go to the CHPT and see what you're doing around that policy. The ESSES will become more and more important. You go on and just become more aware. They do high tech stuff, running models that's using the region computers that you have for all over the world, running 100 computers at night when companies can't run it. Very, very detailed model. It takes hours to get one and do that. This is very, very cool. What we're doing, and this is something that I think we're personally excited about, is something that we call an Earth Systems Master's Program. Part of the challenge in this area is that people have disciplinary understanding. So we have good oceanographers, good seismologists, etc. But we have very few people who have systems of systems. So the idea of the Earth System Master is people work with other specialities, mm-hmm. They have options to put on modules that go beyond their specialities so they can develop a more broader perspective. And globally, this is what everyone is talking about. People will become CEOs of companies, etc. People who have this broader perspective. So we're very excited about this, to be a flagship program of the and hopefully these will become the new generation of leaders in government and business. So they have a good sense of a range of areas that are important. We're setting up a global change monitoring network. I'm working with folks for this to bring very close into our space and earth observation work. We're setting up a very specific project that takes us forward in terms of these 2 PM, especially 4 on global change, society, and sustainability. The kind of questions that could be answered on race and innovation. And this kind of work will feed into long-term planning. Let's give it a more firm of science. The Ministry for Planning has acknowledged, and it's explicit in the green paper, the need to work closely with the Science Council, which is very good, because there's very good work that is happening there. But so this will feed into hopefully what help us as society. We want to set up something called a Bureau on Global Change Science. This is an initiative that brings together leading scientists that have the scientists in the same forum with policymakers and other decision makers. So that when people talk, they're learning from each other and they can take the best science, combine it with what are the requirements of policymakers and issues report. A similar model is like NASA, but slightly different because it's focused on the global change. Being able to say, okay, there's a lot of work that has been done around water security. How does this link up to climate action policy? And you put that information out there for society, for parliamentarians like yourself, for business people, etc. To be able to engage personal change of the day, that has to go through the normal processes, and at least you get answers on the knowledge. We're taking the model of the IPCC. The IPCC has been very successful in shifting minds, in shifting how people do these problems, and this will be a part of the conversation. Then we have something called the Risk and Vulnerability Access. We're also very excited about this project. It's a very initiative these things in mind. It's not a research project, it's a research outreach. So it takes the best research or the best IT tools that we have available and other tools and begin to create ways that people can use the information. So it's going to be web-based initially, but there will also be paper-based products. And the idea is that as a municipal manager, as an example, in remote Limpopo, you will be able to go into the website and be able to pull up information about your climate, the earth, the water, the fire, etc., and to use that information to go into the system. That atlas is going to be combined with something that we call risk and vulnerability assessment centers, and the DMC will be specifically supporting assessment centers in rural universities. In other areas, people use that consultant as such as people. But in rural areas, there's a double jeopardy. First thing, municipalities don't have the funding to get the kind of high level advice that they require. And at the same time, we don't have a knowledge base in those things. So we would be supporting these assessment centers that will support masters and PhD students who then can go out and provide science based knowledge to municipalities. At no cost to them, but the sales cost to be covered by the DSP, the science-based development initiative. They use the atlas as their basis to provide the information that they require, but it would be not expecting people to go to the atlas and make sense of the information, it's to work with people. This is at an early conceptualization level, and it will only be rolled out in the next 5 years. We've been modest with funding limitations that we have, or possibly the third one. And then finally, around the global change, there's some very specific areas that we've identified that we'll be using instruments like the TIA and the Centers of Competence to drive greater technology development in this area. And they broadly relate to this area called environmental systems, or green industry. Our waste sector has opportunities to grow, our water sector has opportunities. Agriculture, in terms of preparing for change, environmental monitoring, even environmental technology. So we're looking at where South Africa has capabilities and strengths, and where do we need to provide additional support so that we become leaders. We're also looking in these areas as the global market. So there might be requirements for water technologies, as an example, in the continent. South Africa is positioned to be able to grow whole new industries and businesses around water, around new technology. There's a very active process, the DTI is very active in this space, so is the Department of Environmental. Then we're working together with them on this area, but looking at the technology development in the next step. On the climate change negotiations, because I gather this may be the one that's more topical and may affect more for the social at the moment. So, and indicate to me whether some of this is to Russia. I just mentioned that briefing notes, and some of what we might highlight here are covered in this, so probably if I'm wrong, but I'm assuming that people have a very basic understanding of the climate change negotiations, because when Les and I started the negotiations, you were thrown in the deep end. You know what top meant, you end up with 15 years and I've spent 2 weeks in Bonn having to learn very, very, very fast. This is how I've done it. And the thing about negotiations is that there's a difference. So some of the essential background is that we have something called the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. And that is when people talk about the negotiation, that's what we're talking about. However, because it's a convention, it has no binding target, essentially a commitment. But that guides a lot. Personally, the UN Expert was a very progressive document when you took into account the science and the some of the measures in there have dealt with issues of justice and fairness and equity. So people who signed that were useful. But the negotiators have been fighting around implementing that convention. The one that we very interested in was an article on technology science, Article 4.5. For 15 years, we've been fighting around how best to implement something that people have been Maybe it's the same with the next guy, whatever we do. The Kyoto Protocol came to the first year that we talked about the negotiation. It's part of the convention. It's a protocol, it's a treaty where countries agree. It's a bit more powerful. They agree to certain binding measures in terms of the reduction in their carbon emissions. The Kyoto Protocol has what we call Annex 1 countries and Annex 2 countries. Annex 1 countries are the ones that are binding emission targets. Annex 2 countries don't have binding emissions. We are developing countries, so we have no commitment under the Kyoto Protocol. The Kyoto Protocol also was agreed to by a large emitter, which is the U.S. The U.S. signed, they were part of the negotiation of the Kyoto Protocol. What they did is they didn't ratify the Kyoto Protocol, which means they weren't an obligation. However, the Kyoto Protocol is enforced because the negotiations require 66% of countries, 70% of countries to ratify. As soon as 70% of countries ratify, they're going to be. So even though the U.S. hasn't ratified the protocol, it's a big issue in terms of innovation. The Kyoto Protocol, in fact, started being enforced last. Commitment period for the first 5 years, which is from 2008 to 2012. So the protocol expires in 2012, and that's why there's an urgency to the protocol that we're going to do. Because of previous experience around how to get a protocol to something that implements the state tax. So we need to agree to, and each of the national governments will take it through their national processes, and then they need to effect it into law, and all of this takes 1 to 2 years. So the idea is if we don't reach an agreement in 2009, we'll have a gap after 2005. Why this is important is because the Kyoto Protocol is created, and I've used this in the slide, some very interesting instruments. And they have financial implications. It's led to the creation of the carbon market. People are aware of this. We have something called the human development mechanism that collects the benefits in time, not as much as it should be. If we don't have a continuity, there's no guarantees on those carbon credits and whether they will be worth it. So there's a real fear and a danger around this level because it can cause a lot of problems. Investments that have been made by countries around CDM studies, etc., may be worth it. That's part of the financial interest. However, the other interest is if we have a gap, we raise the stakes of countries want to do what they want to do. And the IPCC report and others have shown unequivocally that if we don't act now, we are creating problems for ourselves. So there's an importance to get not only a continuation of 2012 to give stability to the carbon market, but also for us to have a more ambitious agreement in Copenhagen that allows us to match the science in terms of what the science is saying is the problem. The science is saying that you can do whatever you want to extend the warming. If you don't do something, if you don't reduce it in 40% and 20% for the world, still 40 years, you can deal with the problem because you can extend it beyond certain thresholds that society will not be able to manage. So that's part of the reason why Copenhagen is however, the negotiations are long-term, and they happen every year. There is something called the COP, which is the Conference of the Parties, which is the supreme body of the UNFCCC. Under the COP, you have two what we call subsidiary bodies, a subsidiary body for implementation, and a subsidiary body for science and technology advice. These meet every 6 months, and they take forward the negotiations. That, for example, is the unfortunate pleasure I used to be of spending 2 weeks every year, in the June of 2020, and negotiating. And these are slow, painful negotiations. Make progress when they import it, and we take responsibility for substrate, which looks at deforestation, measurements, technology. We have the 15th COP, which is in Copenhagen, and I think COP 17 will be hosted in Paris. COP 11, this time is there's some history around this Kyoto thing that I spoke about. In 2005 in Canada, COP 11 in Canada, saw that we need to start negotiating post 2005. At that time, because the U.S. was not part of the negotiation, they agreed to what is called a two-step process. The first step, which is an ad hoc step, it's called the ad hoc working group for long-term cooperative action, was the one that is happening in the U.S. And the second one was an ad hoc working group on the creative process, which excluded the U.S. So we had one process that included them and one process that excluded them. That was the only way we were going to make them forward. So the Kyoto Protocol is the one where the U.S. administration started, and the U.S. government participated in those negotiations. We thought that things would change with the Obama administration, but it hasn't happened quite as we thought. And that's again part of the question that we can put on the U.S. They're saying they'll only come on board in certain things, among 50 developing countries. So this is really China and India, and sometimes they want to. So since 2005, we've had this two-step process that has gradually started framing what this new agreement would be. That new agreement was very well conceptualized recently in Bali in 2007 through something called the Bali Roadmap. The Bali Roadmap managed to take forward this debate in ways that were in line with what developing countries wanted. The first thing that the Bali Roadmap did is it said that we've been focusing too much on mitigation, but adaptation is equally important. And the difference between mitigation and adaptation is mitigation is the long-term carbon projection that we need to mind. Adaptation is saying that we're feeling the effects of past carbon emissions. We're already facing in many parts of Africa water security. Small islands in developing states are under pressure from the tribes, Mauritius, small islands, other small islands. So those countries that are feeling the impact of climate change are saying, we need action now. We've been talking about adaptation, but we've seen nothing from the global community. People must have read in the press that there was a very firm statement from the EU recently saying that if we don't see some movement, particularly around compensation, we may walk out of the negotiation because we're not seeing anything. Adaptation fund that was agreed is listed a few hundred million, whereas the projection shows that we need anything up to $670 billion to adapt. And adaptation means we need to be looking at, for example, if people are affected by drought, how do we get rid of a new carbon crisis? Sea level rise is a big thing. If we're having sea level rise and towns or whole islands are going to be submerged, what do we do? And some islands are already talking about relocating the entire population in the United States. But who's going to bear the cost? Some of the historians of the small islands developing states, when they tell you the case studies of the people, Canada had a recent disaster. It wiped out the GDP. We just couldn't do anything else because we had to deal with the problems that they were facing of storm surge. Part of the argument is this problem was caused by developing. So why should developing countries compromise the development of transport? The debates are complicated because it's linked to development assistance, and we think it needs to be beyond development. It is not, it needs to be not a replacement. So what the Bali Roadmap has managed to do, though, is managed to do the adaptation of the nation almost more easily, which is quite difficult. A big development project is now focused on the nation. By the way, adaptation is no longer developing, more and more developed countries are also talking about it. Just the same, they may not have a key unit, and their entire economy is geared towards Twitter. So, a lot of, from a developing country perspective, however, is scared to cost. The second issue that was quite important was an acknowledgement of what they call means for implementation. They think both mitigation and adaptation are not going to happen if other things are not there. And the other things are crucially finance and technology. They think without movement of finance and technology. So that's where the debate comes. And then I must confess, I think the finance one is really not only who finances, but what's the amount that needs to be financed, and who gets the benefit. There are a lot of discussions about it. Some of the finance in relation to knowledge of what. And then finally, and this is important for scientists, that people are clear. We introduced the concept of what we call MRV. MRV essentially stands for measurable, reportable, and verifiable. And this essentially was the compromise by developing countries in terms of what they were able to. Developing countries were saying, including South Africa, played quite a crucial role. So the Bali Roadmap at the time on the Saturday morning after the Friday session. And there was last minute problem. But essentially, the agreement was that developing countries like South Africa, and we are well positioned to do this, we've done our long term education tonight, would provide the global community with an ambition. We say, this is what we would like to do over the next 30, 40 years, and this is what we do. And if people want to measure that, they can do that. So it will be measurable. We will report to you in terms of our information. We're not saying we do it, we actually have numbers to prove what we do, and it will be verified. So if anyone wants to come to us, please verify whether we reduce our energy consumption or carbon emissions. There's a key compromise. However, MRVs don't mean commitment. We can't be legally out of the country because of the emission. We will try our best to do it, and we will report. We will even show. However, the concept of MRVs is important because it's saying in order to do that, you need to provide us with the incentives. So, for example, if we are building a new coal power fire station and we need to get the most modern technology, which is cleaner technology, and we can't afford it, if we have to build those power stations ourselves, electricity prices will have to double, which we can't afford. Who's going to cover the cost of the difference? What kind of information finance systems are available to allow us to get access to those expensive technologies? But we can't ask our own population to sacrifice our education for free. So people see the complexity around the negotiations and the technology. So we say it's tied into technology and finance. And it's tied into also what are you going to provide in terms of education. So it's a package which looks like this. And this is why it's complicated and negotiations are complicated because each of those elements lead to each other. Mitigation links to adaptation, links to finance, links to technology, and links to what shared vision we have. We have a shared vision that is not ambitious enough because none of our economies can. Are we going to take the plunge now because future generations are going to look back at this generation and say this generation will look back? That's the shared vision we're talking about. What kind of ambition are we going to set ourselves? Because everyone is going to have to take pain. How we share the pain. And how much pain are we willing to take as a role to do it? So for that, that's the model. What is happening around the negotiations? What I really think is that ESG is part of the overall negotiation. We participate in all of the sessions that have been done against the negotiations. We have these specific questions, you know, which way is the distributed intellectual property or outgrown or other institutions, the Department of Environmental Affairs includes international cooperation. We provide mainly at this point the issue of the technology. That's the aim of the link to that, how to find it. So what is happening is the negotiations are happening on all fronts. Movements on education, things are getting more deep around education, and I think if you pick up the papers any day of the week, you see Japan making a they're all small, they're all traditional. A couple of meetings over the next 3 months. In fact, there's a lot of meetings in 3 months. There's one in here this week, followed by a meeting in Bangkok, and another one in Barcelona. And then there's some informal meetings, and there's UN meetings, and then there's September, which is also important in English. So it's very difficult to tell what is happening at this point. Things are very clear. In terms of the formal negotiations, we have what is called a draft negotiation system. That's only the story where we found that the just to give some sense, I was in a negotiation where we spent 3 hours agreeing to 1 cent. So to be on a 38-page text, and all of it is text, which means most. So there's a draft negotiated text, and that tries to bring the elements together. But the key thing that South Africa is championing is that we will do our fair share, and we will do our fair share as part of the MRV approach, measures, reporting. And depending what kind of ambition other people take, we will look at a similar level of effort in our funds. However, we will only do this if we know what certainty we have around science and technology. If that is going to be the means to allow us to achieve what we want to achieve in terms of a low carbon. Our progress is slow, and I'm told that increasingly there are concerns around what can be achieved at COP16 at the highest level. The Secretary General of the UN is trying in his capacity to also communicate to the engagement in terms of South Africa and the global framework. I have indicated that to us, both adaptation and mitigation are crucial, even though we are middle income countries. There are some adaptation measures that we do require support. We can't be told that because we are a low-income country, we don't qualify for developing the system. It's clear that certain things are not of our making. It's part of the fact that developed countries develop on our back in some way. So adaptation is important when we look into measures. On mitigation, the DSQ was involved in terms of the long-term mitigation scenario. It is a very ambitious document, and it's the main commitment. Cabinet has been involved there. But there's a lot of details to work on, exactly how do we get to those parts. It's been acknowledged that technology is going to be an important enabler to allow us to achieve the long-term mitigation scenario. And that's why there's been a lot of support for ESG efforts in terms of energy, of transportation technology, or other mitigation technologies, that we may want to encourage these our ability to achieve what we want to in terms of the long-term mitigation scenario can either be supported or emphasized in the national framework, which that's the position we put in there. We want to do what we have committed to do, what cabinet has committed to do. However, we can't do. On technology specifically, the view is that we need a business unusual approach to technology. We have some mechanisms in place which are ongoing, but those are not necessarily adequate. We need new institutional mechanisms that take the whole technology issue to one level. So, take technology transfer has been happening, but it's been extremely slow over the past few years. Developing countries are so developed with technology, need assessment, and we develop our technology, need assessment, and if they know the private sector will finance, and so we don't have to provide additional finance, and there's all these things that what we're paying attention to is that so we don't know. Where we are now, we need to make an attention, which the G77 in China has endorsed. Maybe we have something called an executive body on technology, which will be empowered to really drive technology transfer. We need a multi-level climate technology fund that will provide the basis to access financing in a much better way now. And then we need a clear international technology action plan. We need to know globally what we're going to do around renewables, what we need to do in the global community to lower the cost of renewables in the global community. We can't leave it up to countries who already have this technology and leave behind. And let me give you a practical example. Renewable energy, there are few world leaders, Japan, China, US, etc. What might happen, in South Africa has an issue, we also say we shouldn't have technology action plans that just allow firms in those countries to continue. Even though we have a we need to be growing our own country, we need to be looking at how we diffuse manufacturing of these climate friendly technologies. So I have in my longest slide details around these areas, and I'm not sure if you've used it. We can talk to you later. Where I want to end is around where we think the way forward is going. And unfortunately, it's not very certain. I don't think anyone can be certain. The negotiations are extremely dynamic at the moment. There's negotiations happening at a formal level, at an informal level. I saw in the press recently that we have people coming here from the UK, I don't know if they're in Parliament. There's an informal pressure. Civil society is organized, both developing and developing countries. So for political scientists, this is a wonderful thing, how things are really happening, and who's putting pressure on who, etc. But it's debate on this. I don't know what's happening in the keeping our eye on the ball. And South Africa is part of the key, some of the key discussions that I've mentioned in this conference. South Africa was seen as a beach builder. We are quite well accepted in the international negotiations, coming up with ideas with friends that. But what we have to do with that is we also have to keep in mind our own issues, which we have to manage. I told you that we have a problem, and this is bound to happen. I'm sure parliamentarians will also be talking about this. Fellow parliamentarians, it's important that we maintain a unified position in which is the one that cabinet is our focus remains development, willing to do our share. What happens over the next few months only kind of points into how it
more than 10 years.
Might not have been in today's start,
Where are they going to? Innovative way of maintaining them in the rural areas, because they are going to or they are migrating to the urban areas because of jobs and better life and things like that. But if develop something that will make them to stay in the rural areas, we will not have this problem, because no matter how we develop Cape Town, Durban, Johannesburg, but the influx of people from rural areas will not match the development. But also at the same time, we need money to develop these cities and things like that. So that's my problem. If you could clarify me, because at the moment the government is saying let us also develop the rural area to make sure that people stay there, they don't go to urban areas.
Thank you. Just for a point of information to start off, I was privileged to represent Parliament and ITU in Bali in 2007. So I think we performed today undergraduate quite nice. From a caucus point of view, I belong to the DA, and 2 weeks ago we had a similar presentation, and one of the challenges that I've seen to all members of Parliament is that we should all determine our human carbon footprint. So that's an exercise all of us are going to indulge in, and you actually pose generic questions to each minister in cabinet to tell us have they calculated the human footprint. Now, I would like to refer to your second last slide, please. When you refer to current institutional arrangements are insufficient, are you referring to the ministry itself? When you say institution, which institution are you referring to? And then if you can elaborate, when you want to see an executive body on technology, who would you like to be seen sitting on that? Would it be, political? Would it be the different ministries like education and health and so on? And then the second point, your multilateral climate tech technology fund. How do you see that fund coming about? Is it something that Treasury would have to undertake, or would it be a specific ministry? And how do you see that fund be administered? Would it be for university research? Would it be for projects on the ground? Is it a private-public partnership? I'd like some expansion.
No, but on the contrary, I thought that I was a trade in the Financial Commission. When it was launched in March, it was launched under the direction of Obama. That is why it was launched in this U.S. unit. Second, the advisor to Obama is the one who is the chair of the International Commission on Climate Change. And I've got declaration that has been made in March, during the launch, we got sent to G20, Heads of State, and in Rome in June, we got sent to the G8, S25, the Heads of State. And there is a bill that is being run through the House of Parliament in the US, which has been developed by Senator Markey, which is seeking actually to address this specification of big countries supporting the small countries and technology transfer and also. The bill is a 600-page bill, which is called Marquis Waxman Bill. It's going to be, they are speeding it up so that by the Copenhagen conference, it has been passed to the House of Congress in the US. It has already, I understand, when we're in Rome, it has already passed to the first House, and then it was around September, October. October, or when the legislators forum meet in the Copenhagen before the September conference, it has been passed, which therefore drives the G8 countries to finance and try to go into developing economy. So I do not know, I just want you to clarify me, because I have been frustrated in the commission and usually before the declaration is sent through to the legislature. Because of the importance of South Africa, they usually give me to read and see if it is really correct and where I feel like it doesn't properly into our treatment, and I'm always guided by so it's a poster stuff of what our person has. So I want you to clarify me why you think that you have not done anything in the open. The third question is, Copenhagen, as far as I understood, is that it will be adopting phase two of the Kyoto Protocol. I just want to understand from what you've said, how the U.S. As far as I understand, the U.S. was not part of the Kyoto Protocol. You have mentioned two platforms now. I know in this commission that we are working in the status, we are supposed to work out a package that would make it possible that in 2012, that before the members of the United Nations are able to start. They usually talk about this is actually one of the positions of South Africa. We want to have shared but differentiated responsibility. Can you clarify what exactly we try to mean when we say shared but differentiated? And then finally, there is the problem of technology. The European Union, I understand, is working on a project, the CCS project, common sector and education. But they say that they are very much in French share, I think it's making that funny. Share. Actually, in Rome and in Washington, this is a lot shared. So, I think we need to be I think also the workshop was there to present how far they have come in developing the hospitals. But we are saying, as you said, it's very expensive. But the Canadian said that they have got a method that is almost finished, it's not expensive, it's an ice method, and that is probably you can clarify up to me. That's what I'm asking for.
These institutional arrangements you're talking about are not parasitic, they're international. So they take the body, multilateral families, and not become the contributions to the country. So, why this is what we are proposing in parasitic experiments in 2007. Because these are the improved institutions. At the moment, we are very little funding, and we have a very weak structure to drive technology forward. We are funding for an expert in all agencies. They can't be a lot more direct and indicate that these were the issues raised by Kenya in terms of the location, and it identified the need for these kinds of technologies. what is being done by the global community to address. So this is international negotiation speak in terms of the lesson. Let me go now in the order of some of the questions to ask. Are we going to set the example? I think it's clear, and that's why I was very glad that the committee asked for a briefing of the Global Change Brain Challenge and the Climate Change Negotiations. And I tried to introduce that we have another Brain Challenge around energy. The approach of the DSP is very strong that yes, we want to strengthen these areas of practice. And we see an opportunity as science and technology in these negotiations. And we will do whatever we can to take advantage of those opportunities, whether it's renewable energies, water energies, etc. The key part is to step up. And that's the argument behind it. But there's very good work happening already. What's required is to hold on. So, yes, we've taken that, and I think the same approach we've taken in general by government economic stuff. The big thing, if you look at the program of action, it has an item there on greening it in the future. And then view that there's possibilities in this. It's clear that that's what we want to do. Some of the areas raised by the work, just for clarity, the DFT, I think, always gets asked this question. I always verify that large-scale rollout of implementation is not how we want to do it. Where we do come in is to demonstrate new technology, to show that things are possible. So we do have demonstration projects in the country. We're looking at how to use solar in housing, how you deal with waste management. But ultimately, we need the mechanism that other departments supply to allow for those projects to happen. So when you talk about waste, it's a very interesting project in Germany, although it has the African has published it, so they see the landfill stuff and convert it into methane. And they're getting money because of the CDM credit. Now, that example is there for everyone to see. It's not DSP's role to tell you the policies. We were talking about the effects in the context of the effects on the policies. But what needs to happen is that the pressure needs to be made by those communities, by whoever, to get those councils to look at them. There are interesting things happening. I saw that Joburg City, for example, is now introducing separation of waste. So these examples are out there. Those examples were spread out, and unfortunately, there's not something that we can do. So when it comes to new ideas, for example, when you're talking about seawater desalination, it's a well-established technology. But once again, like any technology, price is important. Electricity is going up now. As an example, I just saw my most recent dollar, and so now I see market up for the next year. Similarly, if water goes up for high-end users, not for the front, it will make certain things more viable. If the projections show that we will have water scarcity and the way to apportion it out is really difficult, then we may have to look at it. However, personally, I think that we have shorter term gains to it, because desalination is high tech. It takes a long time to get the cost efficiency that certain countries like Israel and others will have. So we spend many years perfecting the technology. What's more important for us to do is to look at water recycling, ways of reducing our consumption in agriculture. Agriculture uses a lot. So how can we recycle water? And as an example, I'm told, interestingly, and this is where there's been a positive influence. People are talking about workers in mines saying, no, you can't use potable water to cool
So it's a lot more complex. There are issues of possibility. I know that the Department for Water Service and Forestry is looking at desalination in a big way. But it's a long term. We just have to develop and the problem with desalination is it has a high energy requirement. The desalination is energy. And energy relates to carbon emissions. So you have to look at overall. The price is going to be important. Similarly with your example around Toronto and the east the south, we've been facing this problem for 30 years. I would say in South Africa our interest should not be how to reduce carbon emissions by moving away from coastal. The problem with coastal is that the important problems with people's health, which is the bigger reason why we need to go to I'm saying we must maintain some perspective. Climate change is a big issue. But we shouldn't make it such a big issue that we take the wrong decisions. We have to act on that problem. Because it's a problem that's causing health requirements. And we need to look at how we extend electricity in those areas so that people don't have to look at it. We need to look at what's the basic measure of electricity. What's the basic amount of like even so that they don't go to coal. For a while people are using coal, they need for warmth. And maybe we should spend more in terms of designing more houses that are more useful. So it's a set of different things. It's not a, and I know these are being discussed. We are looking at this because of the funding. But in science and technology.
So, the science design has developed these systems of these.
Well, they are supposedly the world leading.
We know
today
for. Technology for them.
Sometimes it's a question of learning, not necessarily just importing or changing solutions. The technology, what you need to do is you need to look at your own environment, the set of technologies, and you need to build the capabilities to be able to improve the technology. So I know that the Department of Water Service and Forestry is looking at contamination. Which countries are they looking for in terms of technology? I just know that. Really done. But then the issue is cost may not have been affected in Israel because they want to scarce to the lazy relevant and we may not. So there's a set of issues that are not really around Israel. I know that like renewable energy, it is an area that is going to look at in people because no technology will come if you don't develop the people. So it's a longer term process and they're looking at it longer term. The point I was making is that water has a number of solutions and desalination and now into something personal carbon capture and storage may sound sexy, but they big projects. They big risks. They shouldn't affect us. We must look at the science. But at the same time we must look at those things. So with carbon capture and storage, that is not technology that will in a big some countries are pushing carbon capture and storage because they can then sell it to the market. We saying that we will look at that and we are doing work in South Africa to do a carbon to look at where can we store. We are capturing carbon at the moment. That's not such a problem. The problem about the storage. Because we have to find what they call geological so the first step in the 2-year project is to look at whether we can capture. If we can capture then we get to the next step by taking a small amount of carbon and putting it underground and seeing how it works. People say it's safe, but you have to do it. You have to do it. So carbon capture and storage is not a short-term solution. It's not even a short-term solution globally. There's a lot of debate around it, but what some people argue, like the NGOs, and that is that they're saying we're trying to not take the difficult decisions. We're not changing our lifestyle. We're
hopefully one day fathers will change stories to themselves also. This is how the debate is on. My view is we must pursue fathers to change stories like other institutions or people to the truth. But at the same time, we need to do some of the more difficult work around how do we use our population to the truth. So desalination is the same kind of issue. It's a possibility. It will come on its own. But it's something that we will have to look at later. Initially, there might be other ways of improving our water treatment, wastewater, and recycling.
So, actually, just around that, in the area of interest, in some of the rural areas where I grew up, there were areas where there was green water. Now, is there, which I think there is, a technological system which can detect in some of the areas if there is clean water. So I'm saying, as much as they this that the scarcity of water that is coming on the road, but in some, I'm sure some major rural areas, there are areas where there is clean water. How then is that effective nature? I'm of the view that you also assist the rural development ministry in detecting those areas.
There are long-term work happening under the Constitution of Science and the map, what's happening on geological formation, etc. Where there's possibilities to come there, then once the science has done its work and identified, others need to come in and work on it. On your Guinea brief, interesting, I just want to comment because I have another project in my portfolio, which took me a while to understand because you were saying you need money to keep chicken breeds alive. Indigenous chickens. It came like the Guinea itself. Under the ARC, they have a project which they're struggling to keep funding because it's expensive. And it's what we call keeping the gene bank alive, keeping genetic material. But not only genetic material, but actual chickens. So they eat them, and one diet of chicken because the only way to maintain that the stock. That's how we were able to go back. So it's not only a cattle. We have gene stock on wheat, we've got gene stock on indigenous, for example, indigenous cabbage and toads. We have eggs, and people are saying we're able to take that back now and we find a need and regrow it. It's not only about climate change, it's about taste. People prefer certain things. So they prefer the taste of certain goats. It was an eye-opener when I had a briefing from the ARC about the work that they're doing just maintaining the gene collection. And then they spoke about six indigenous chickens or hens that they're keeping growing. And these come from the pre-colonial times when they have their collections. So once there's a need for it and there's funding, then they'll be able to do it. It's just an example. So when we talk about food security, it's a whole range of other areas, more staple products, how to grow more agriculture, how to maintain their wheat. Planning for sustainable urban development, where scientists, research never encourages anything. You do research based on what you think is happening. So yes, the policymakers may want to reverse, but the analysis that we see globally is that people are becoming more urbanized. Even where they've tried in countries like China and India to stem the tide of urbanization, they've tried it, basically developing research. And it's important to continue. But long term, if you talk about 30, 40, 50 years' time, the general trend is that more and more people are that's the global trend. They just put in the verdict. Even if it's not in urban centers, it's in
more populated because it becomes more cost effective from transport perspective. So what we're doing as a science firm, as a research firm, is acknowledging the reality. If the reality changes in 10 years, then we'll do different research. But for now, the research indicates the tipping point has been reached globally. More than 50% of people are now in urban areas in the world. I don't think it's slightly different. But if you look at the trend slowly from a long-term projection, it's not going backwards. More and more people are coming to urban. So what we need to do is, if we know that it's happening, then let's rather look at how we design our systems so that they're more sustainable in the long term. Not to encourage people, but to ensure that when we do have systems, they're livable, they have the immunity, that they're dealing with things like their waste and energy. The reality also is that urban areas are more costly, more efficient when it comes to the resource increase. The more people live together, less transport costs, etc., you can really concentrate on it. So the research is just aimed to do that. It's not to encourage or discourage. I think that will be a combination of many, many factors. But the reality is, from our assessment, that this is a long-term trend in terms of organization. So let's at least understand how they are more sustainable. Even if we have the current city, let's look at how we redesign our current city. So the people who are born in the city and all the area, they're part of the city. Because I'm not an urban person. And then the questions of the church. The concept of meditation and the concept of litigation. Essentially, litigation is a way to understand what we are less likely to do in the carbon. When they say you mitigate, it means you put out less carbon dioxide or it's equivalent. It's not only carbon dioxide, it's carbon. It's methane, there's what we call the 60 greenhouse gases. And it's trying to reduce the amount of this that we need. And the reason why mitigation is important is because science has shown that there's a link between greenhouse gases and temperature increase. So what is being said by the science is by reducing carbon dioxide and mitigation, we'll be able to bring down your temperature. Now, where there's still some debate is what is the extent of the mitigation? And as the science gets better and better, the IPCC report over the years became more and more strict. Now they're saying that what we have to do is if we take all of the carbon dioxide we have now, we need to get to 15% of what we emit now. We're really going to cut down. But if we continue, all we're going to do is how do we prevent it? And it's all around modeling the science. No one knows for sure whether we're right or wrong. As the science gets better and better, we're able to tell we're improving our projection. That's mitigation. So as an example, how the TTM projects work is that if we were going to build a housing development project, and we were going to use what people will do is calculate how much carbon dioxide would have gone into that building construction. And then if we use new technology, new approaches, then we can calculate how much we are actually using now. The difference between what we would have put in and the new method is what we calculate, what we present. And that's how you approach the calculation. So it's a complex science. There's something called greenhouse gas, South Africa's greenhouse gas inventory. All countries are required to calculate the greenhouse gas. And internationally, there's methodology for this. We look at energy generation, we look at transport, how many cars there are, how we can generate our electricity, and we calculate what amount of greenhouse gas is emitted. If you reduce that amount, then we are making. That's the concept.
why do they allow you to pray at a level of church or pre-1990 level?
I think it's because, and it's definitely weird that they're looking at it, because we have a record for those years. Because countries did basically now say pre-1990 level. So what you're able to do is, you can't, the US or South Africa or Japan or whatever will not be able to tell what they if you don't have a baseline. The 1990, sometimes 2000, I use this baseline to say, in that year, this is about to come out. So we need to calculate whether we are going down or up based on this. That's the concept. So there's a big science around greenhouse gas, like there's thousands of scientists improving the methodology year by year, and there's international methodology. That's why the MRV is important. Because when we say verifiable, we do our own greenhouse gas emissions. And we have just done the one for Paris in 2005. And they sent it out. So ESCOM, for example, or CESOL, or whoever, can come back and question whether those numbers are right. Okay? And then there'll be a process. And then ultimately, we will be just the methodology. Let me clarify in case this goes out and has a problem with negotiation. The issue around the Obama administration is not that they're not doing it, but they're not doing as much as we had anticipated, which we've done in terms of that. So there might be the International Commission, and I know about the McKay, Bexley, those are local. When it comes to the negotiation, the negotiators are still maintaining an old position. So, you know, these are systems. So it might be said at one level, but what we think, and this is very important for us as South Africa, the U.S. has created alternatives, or tries to create alternative negotiating places. So we've got commission, we have a relation with this country. South Africa's position has been very clear. There is only one negotiating point, and that's the U.S. We don't see movement in the UN advocacy, nothing else comes. Right? Even if countries make noises and announcements in the papers and in the press, it doesn't matter until you start committing in the negotiations. And the point is, you're not seeing the commitment in the negotiations. On the area we're interested in, around technology transfer, no movement. They say, we can't. Technology belongs to companies. It's the same lines that we use. So that's more the point. So part of what we've seen in other places is the political.
As far as I understand, in that field is being developed in preparation for the UNFCCC in Copenhagen. That's what I understood from Chile Cameron. That's what you have just said.
About the Western cable, I think it's the West. So what they're doing is they're saying, yes, we do this, but the U.S. has always maintained the position that we don't want to be forced to do something. And the global negotiation is you're forced to accept amongst your peers a certain target. And that's not what they do. So the thing doesn't matter, because your domestic legislation, we can't leave it. But once you sign Kyoto Protocol, then it's a different method, and we're now obligated to the peers. So that's a slight difference. And I think, and I have to be skeptical, things like the International Commission on Climate Change is ways in which thousands of debates have been given. And then South Africa has maintained a very, very strict position. When we were invited to the major investment conference, we attended as one of the 15 countries, but we said, look, we can't create alternatives in education process. You can't make a deal among the professionals. Any deal has to happen among the community of nations that belong to the United Nations, because it's a dividing rule. It's dangerous for us to make a deal outside of the world. So it's part of that. And I think we can from the president, whatever you said, you can maintain that there's only one negotiation. So that's more the case. I think, like I said, what happens over the next 3 months, we don't know. Things may change. We might see, even over the next 2 weeks, we might see a different position coming from the EU or the US or China or India, wherever. But at the moment, they still haven't bought into the need for a global agreement on security.
The International Commission, which is the Danish Prime Minister, who is the head of the United Nations, is also part of the But he was really wrong there because this forum actually does nothing except it highlights the importance of developing countries being covered in their contact by the Development Council and these are the conditions of Brazil and Brazil is also part of that. The Lisbon is also part of that. And that is why I'm saying that in preparation for the Copenhagen Conference, positions that the Chinese are also part of that. The Mexicans are part of that. Actually, over and above the G20 countries, they are also at the same. They call them fast developing economies, other outside the G8. Australia, South Korea, and Indonesia also confirmed to be part of this. So that when it goes to Copenhagen, all these countries go on a common position of compromise agreement.
I would just a point to clarify, the negotiations are complex, and South Africa has maintained a number of support in terms of our position. We work very closely with African countries in close space. None of those are included in the international commission. Then we work very closely with our other fast developing countries, like India and Brazil, etc. And then we have the G77. And at any of the negotiations, positions on a daily basis go through Africa. We have an African meeting, we have the G77 meeting, etc. The danger of saying this is the position of the International Commission with these countries is that it hampers your negotiating position amongst your peers. Because the danger for South Africa is if we're seen as outside of Africa, which is why we were not being seen on creating alternative negotiating forums as the US wanted. Because if we do that, we are compromising ourselves against our peers. And in some way, it helps us and it supports us, backs us up. So these are quite difficult, but if you've been liaising closely with Foster and others in the team, then it's useful because they better place. My sense, though, is that when we go to the International Commission on Climate Change and we go to things like the major emissions conference, we always go back to say, we will come and see you. We can have discussions here. We can learn from each other, but we can't commit anything to the International Commission. We can only commit in the negotiations. So that's it's quite different because there was an attempt to corner, I must confess, with a major emergency conference, major funders, media. And we said, no, you come here, we listen. We'll share ideas. We'll move the agenda because we don't want to be a stumbling block. But what we have to do is we have to go back at every of the formal negotiations, and that's where we reserve the right to make clear what our position is. Whatever comes outside of that in the informal is not our formal position. Our formal position only comes to the negotiation.
Well,
in fact, it's very important to be able to influence position in that committee, because that is information that takes its dimension to the head of state of this country. And in reality, also the positions that are talking about of Africa, especially, those are the positions that are South Africa came with in that area, which have been accepted and taken. So I think I'm sure the more you understand what the role of that commission is, the more you understand that it is very, very central and significant in conveying, especially the position of the Chief of Congress.
Yeah, I think I just want to add to my colleague, Mr. Patel, that the arrangement is that all the negotiations, formal negotiations, will happen under the framework of climate change, the recognition of the UNFCCC. But however, you cannot prevent parties or countries from lobbying their position with other countries that they feel that are influential in this process. The forum that you're referring to, is, of course, it's a lobbying process. If the outcomes of that discussion that's happening are not forcing the U.S. to come to the UNFCCC forum to say we commit that we will take this funding title to the negotiators under the UNFCCC, we still see the U.S. as not part of the deal, because whatever that is coming after the framework is not recorded for the framework to consider. The other thing that I want to talk about is the, as I say, the person who raised the question is gone, and I'm not sure if it's still relevant that we talk about it. It's still relevant. Okay. I think it's more on the technology transfer, because our interest is on technology transfer. When my colleague started discussing the negotiation part of this presentation, he indicated the groupings of the negotiating parties. We have developed countries, such as developing countries. Under developed countries, we have one country. Those are the countries that are all developed. But answer two are the developed countries, but that those countries will have commitment to support developing countries in terms of finance and technology. So it's the commitment. There's an article that talks to technology transfer being made by developed countries to developing countries. But there have been studies that have been conducted for the past 15 years. The technology transfer has been effective. The study collected data from the companies and countries who have capabilities in transferring the climate change or environmentally sound technologies. And it shows that about 160 billion has been spent. And of that amount, everything was happening outside the convention. So we need something within the convention that will assist developing partners that are incapable of forgiving partnerships with developed countries, so that we can start using the technologies to address the climate change issue. That's when the issue of a new executive body comes in. that, you know, the body comes in the form of those design committees that will look at the technology action plan, the funds, and that fund should be sustainable. And the funds will be funded by the developed countries because they have a commitment under the convention to support energy transfer in the developing countries. And that fund should be predictable. We should know that in the next financial budget we will have so much to support energy transfer. So that's what we are questioning. And it's not something that is happening at the national level, it's at that level, at the market level. I just wanted to clarify that.
This concept of shared potential to defend policies, I think that's just the heart of this debate. It's essentially saying that we all have responsibilities. However, what we have to understand is that we all are not responsible for creating problems in energy. So the balance, the greater effort that's required to prevent future emissions and to deal with future mitigation belongs to or is the responsibility of developed countries. So that's why it's important to get language in the International Commission, because I thought there was a very, very, that's a phrasing was wonderful. It captures a lot. If the International Commission on Climate Change doesn't acknowledge shared potential responsibility, it's core to justice, to a just climate change regime. And that's where people push the boundaries, because they say, no, China, India, South Africa must take it. And we say, yes, we will take on, but we have differentiated responsibility. And our responsibility is we'll do whatever is in our means to mitigate. But we have to bear a bigger responsibility, because if we have, if we use our 70% of our carbon space, the remaining 30% can't be shared equally. We have to share that unequally towards developing countries. Developed countries will use that nation. They don't have to get nothing more. We have to get that in order to develop our people. So that principle is very crucial, and scientific and I think developing countries will make sure that we get that language always, because it's been approved in the convention. We always put that in the preamble. We acknowledge your comments. We have shared the differentiated responsibility. And on that basis, so I think you picked up that that's a very, very key principle that you have to go back all the time.
You know, it's because that was the principle I from Dr. Porter when I went to Washington. That this is our position, that we accept shared but refrigerated responsibility. And I found that when I arrived in the commission, that's the paper. That's where they were exactly saying that. That's why I wanted to know the detail of where it came from. It's what I was given. This is the position you all play.
Thank you. This is not that
wordy. The trick is, what does share and potential responsibility mean? And that's what I'm trying to explain. We must be careful that we don't take on a burden that is unfair, that is not essential. And that's why the MRV becomes important. Because we say we will do our best. But we'll do our best if we get support in terms of technology and science. And then we will attempt to do as much as we can without compromising. So that it's not that deadline is difficult. It's how they take that basic identification.
I think the honourable member wanted to ask.
Thank you, President. Just to remind us on the risk and mobility assessment. The identification of the challenge and the identification of these
universities, rural universities, what methods are we going to use to identify them and prioritize them? What should happen there so that you can say it's our first priority?
It's simple and pragmatic. It will depend on our willingness to assist in existing capacity. So the approach would be to, once we have the consent, send it out. There's one of five key rural universities we're talking about. We'll send it to all five, and we'll indicate that we're willing to support it. And they need to come forward and say we're interested, and this is what we will do. And then we work with people. If more than one they are ready and we have the finances, then we do. The long-term ambition is to have time. So it's not it's much more pragmatic than a selection. It would be based on, do they have the computer facility? Do they have even someone who's core to this? You know, they have no master's level student who understands risk and vulnerability, then maybe the first step is to train people. So we might have to do that training first before we set up a center. So at the moment, it's going to depend on capacity, willingness, and then obviously the university has to come with something that has to make available space for these centers. We will support as far as possible with human capital development. So we guide it purely by scientific decisions, not political.
Perhaps I can add one of the related parts, Honorable Member, is called the one in the human and social dynamics. And what we have done on behalf of the Department of Science and Technology and in pursuit of particularly the rural universities is that universities themselves, through the high education in South Africa, have been discussing this differentiated mode. Not necessarily because you want to go back to the old system of saying, you know, these are disadvantaged, but to try and find their own economic basis and what it is that they can make contributions to. And they've decided on it. So right now, in fact, on one aspect, we already engaged with Fort Hare and their own community engagement, and in fact, the whole Nguni cattle projects that are there, which is again funded by the department, University of Zululand, invest of the Popo, Venda, and but what we also want, the issue about the others coming on board, for instance, the issues of University of Northwest University becomes an issue to say how do you put them in, pull them in as you proceed because of there's one location. But at least there is already an identification amongst themselves in terms of trying to identify, and in order for them to define themselves in terms of their own impact as they can. So it's an exciting thing.
Right, thank you very much. I think members have come to the end of this session. Let me thank you, all of you from the department, for having made your presentation and clarified the members. The DG has said that he is forming up a task team on the IU, but the task team on the climate change. The
department has a leading role in the climate change. I wasn't sure what the task team was thinking and had been referring to, but internally we have a unit that's focused on climate change, and then we work with, on the negotiations, we work with our colleagues in international relations. On South Africa, the responsibility is mine and the but the framework for our work in climate change is the global change framework. I'll get clarity from the on what tasking is very closely with I must indicate that in climate change we work very strongly with the interdepartmental system. intergovernmental committee on climate change, and this is part of this, and we work at the city, we're part of the National Climate Change Committee. So, yes, I think they can see the DGs in Russia as well because a lot of only with these with the environmental things on the negotiations. So, but I find out that.
Okay, then a lot of members, other members have left because they had some commitments, but I don't know. Members from the opposition, I don't know why they're not interested in this. But nevertheless, I think it was very useful for you to orientate the committee on this matter because it seems Parliament is very left behind from what is happening in the question of climate change. And that is why I thought that. Thank you very much, and I will hope to hear from you.